gosh. I'm flattered and honored by all those words. I mean, you have no idea when you're... To hear those things about yourself leaves me speechless, really. Thank you so much for all your hospitality since I arrived here in Richmond. I've never been here before. It's a beautiful, beautiful city. My friend Robert, who I met over the phone at Brooks Brothers, who lives here, gave me a brief tour of that street with all the monuments. It was so pretty. And then I went to dinner at, where did we go to dinner? It was a great restaurant. I recommend it highly. Edo Squid. It was great. I don't know what to do, so I'll just read these poems. I didn't know what to read, but I did just want to say that I am honored to receive this prize, and it was great to hear about Mr. Levis and his poems, and it's an honor to be here. I'm humbled and grateful and honored to the bone, and I wanted you to know that. So I didn't know what to read. But then I was sitting next to Mary Flynn, and she was telling me that Edgar Allan Poe grew up here, which I did not know. And that got my mind going, as it sometimes does. And I remembered that when I wrote this poem I'm going to read to you, there was a word that I stole from Mr. Poe. The word is tintinnabulating. And I just loved it from the first time I read it many, many years ago. And I thought, there's got to be a place that I can put this in somewhere. It means, you know, the sound of ringing bells, for those of you who don't know what that means. And it's a little poem. I wrote it in honor of two friends in Palm Beach that were getting married. And it's called Chiaroscuro, which is, you know, in a painting when there's light and dark. It's simply an evocation of the town of Palm Beach. If you haven't been there, I hope you get the chance to go. Just evoking that town at the end of the season. Chiaroscuro. When the ficus beyond the grillwork darkens, when the rind cools down on the lime, when we sit here a long time, when we feel ourselves found, when the red tile roofs deepen to brown, when the exhausted beach fires with blues, when the hush of the waves reminds us of regrets, when the tides overtake the shore, when we begin to place God in our sentences more, we will turn at last. We will admire the evening's fading clues, uncertain of what the dark portends as another season ends. And the fabulous visitors depart in luxury cars. We will savor the sharp light from the summer stars. We will rejoice in the fronds tintinnabulating down these empty streets, these beautiful streets with all these beautiful names. Kings, Algoma, Via Bellaria, Clarendon, Via Vizcaya, Via Del Mar, El Vedado, Banyan, El Brillo, El Bravo, Via Marina. As they were invoking the spirit of Larry Levis, I was thinking, oh gosh, I hope they don't start chanting, boring, boring. I try to keep this on the shorter side. I think poetry readings are like going to the museum. I was just on a vacation. I went to a few museums, and you can just take in a few things, at least I can, and then I can't take any more. I have to run out of the Louvre. I was having dinner, and two tables over was this person who I thought that I remembered from college, which was now, I hate to say, 25 years ago. And I thought, gosh, that looks a lot like Billy Adams. And then I got back to the conversation at the table, and then lo and behold, it was. And he's here tonight, and I feel so honored that he made the trip to come to this reading. And he's an architect now. And I thought, well, I'll read this poem because it's about a house. And so maybe Billy will, I don't know if you're still called Billy, maybe it's William now or something. But back then it was Billy. This is a poem called Cape Cod, and it's about a house that my family owned, and I think that's all I have to tell you. I gotta get more water. Are there any questions? It's a little nerve-wracking giving these readings. I'm used to being behind a sales counter more than this podium, but every time I do it, the first time I gave a reading, it was like, oh gosh, I was crying. It was really a shock to me to find myself. I had worked on this book for over 20 years, really, and so I didn't ever think it would come to this. So, the poem. It begins with a quote from a poet I love, T.S. Eliot, from the Four Quartets, and the quote is, "Houses live and die." Cape Cod. Inside, everything was Episcopalian. The wicker chaise lounges, the small spotted mirrors, the rattan dining room set, the tears. No one saw tears. We hid them, especially the men who buried their tears in the sea. Or so I once dreamed and wrote down until the dream became what I believed and what I wrote. Our family owned a large house by the sea, built in 1902, white as a hospital. There was a wraparound porch where old rockers rocked, regardless of whether or not people rocked in them. Martha's Vineyard winked from each room. The island whispered, "I will be lovely, but never too close." Each bedroom was painted a different color, green, pink, yellow, blue, red. Corresponding gingham curtains and gingham bedspreads inhaled and exhaled the sea, creating a refrain of sighs and regrets, part of the rhythm of the place. Our iron bed squeaked when we jumped in. We read warped books filled with sand. I don't remember that we talked much. Why didn't we talk much? The wainscoting downstairs was dark, shiny, smooth as church pews. All the house's corners were obscure, not filled in. The windows had two rows of small panes on top and a large bottom sash with thick, smoky glass. And so our vision was a curious combination of miniaturist boxes and expansive, cropped, abstracted seascapes that never could get enough of the world jammed into them. But always there was distance. Distance and occlusion. Two staircases xylophoned with the steps of guests, relatives, and summer help. There was even a great aunt who had sung for the Met. Her hair was dyed the color of champagne, and she had a nose job and a topaz amulet. She was old, had married badly, and embodied regret. Although she had known the love of crowds, which dragged behind her like a wedding train. There was a yacht club meeting every summer with a cannon that went off. Ba-boom. Women arrived in their thin Talbot's belts carrying wicker purses shaped like paint cans with whalebone carvings fastened on top, resembling the hardened excrement seagulls drop. Occasionally the purses would open, albeit reluctantly, like safe deposit boxes. Men wore cranberry trousers and Brooks Brothers blue blazers. The same nervous postures came with the martinis. We all repeated the same orchestrated blocking. Names grew few, more and more the same. Those with sexual peculiarities hid, which meant most of us hid. The seagrass zithered somberly. and the Rosa Rugosa filled in the background with a red quivering, like eyes saddened or irritated, held in check by pruned privet hedges, and the waves drew in. The waves drew out. In, out, in, out. Like a long, important political speech no one recalled but everyone knew. Old station wagons came, went. The beach stretched out in a long boomerang arc, and the shoreline was speckled with dark, purplish seaweed flecks. An endless message written for someone. Sometimes an enormous fog rolled in, erasing the sea, the roads. One year, a neighbor killed herself. Her husband returned the following summer with a new wife who looked like the first wife, only younger. Time passed. She grew old. The yacht club meetings still continue, as far as I know. And often, at night, in summer, the fireflies still grow dizzy. Or are they stars? Maybe both. The station wagons still rattle down the sandy roads, getting stuck in the dunes by drunk teens, lost to the tedium of love's small scale, their inaccurate kisses drowned out by the sea with its deeper secrets, the sea that shifts and advances and undoes itself with whispers. One September, after the season had ended, an austere real estate agent appeared from Sotheby's, opening our front door with his very own keys. His gestures were rehearsed, yet chummy. We were the dead, and the living had come to size us up. Silver candlestick holders lay on the floor. Photographs of people who looked a lot like us were shoved into garbage bags. The Massachusetts sky was small and cold. Our house was sold. I'll read you two more poems. This poem is called Triptych. It's in three parts. I'm 42, so the early memories that I have growing up in America was the Vietnam War. The music at the time was being heard on something called the Ed Sullivan Show, and there were all kinds of great rock and roll acts that came into our living room in our little basement apartment in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And also it was the rise of Black Power. We had the first Black woman run for president, Angela Davis. And it's a poem that tries, I guess, to come to terms with difficult issues around family of origin, I guess, might be a buzzword, where there's mental illness and alcoholism. Triptych. One, politics. My mother canvasses for Nixon among Angela Davis supporters. Already she looks sad, strained, trying to resemble Jackie Kennedy. I am six. The Ed Sullivan Show is on. Janis Joplin shakes with pain. Already I know this ugly singer from Port Arthur, Texas, understands all my mother will endure. What happened to my mother? What disturbed her all her life. One day she will say things to me. She will call me an abomination. Two, homosexuality. After my mother and father fight, my father takes my hand, and we walk down to the Mississippi where he smokes Camel cigarettes. He flicks his ashes away from me. He rarely says my name. All day on TV, I watch monks in Saigon douse themselves in gasoline and light their saffron robes on fire. When they ignite, they do not cry out. I study their silence to comprehend how a tongue turns into flame. 3. Easter. I am young, 6 or 7. My sweat does not smell. I am not an angel kicking the can, playing doctor. My father's drinking is bad. He slurs his pandemonium with the words God and Christ. He bursts with perils, dooms me with promises. Outside, the Mississippi pushes faster, forces its voice down the banks of Sumac, connecting tributaries and creeks. My soul is now deep and moves like the river. All right, one last poem for you. Thank you for everything, for recognizing these poems. They almost feel separate from me, like another entity. So I'm happy for them when I get word of their recognition. This last poem is called Florida Ghazals. It's in 7 parts. And the ghazal, David Wojahn was mentioning that. And it's really a pleasure and an honor to meet him. I had read his poems over and over again. There was this anthology called the Murrow Anthology. Is that what the name of it was? Yeah. So it was one of the few modern anthologies that I had when I lived for many years in this farmhouse, and I would read them over and over and over again. Little did I know that I'd get to meet him one day. So this poem is called Florida Ghazals. It's about Florida. It's about hurricanes, which is, you know, let's take a moment and say a little prayer for all those people that are about to get hit. I know what that's like. It's not fun. We get a lot of them in Florida. The ghazal is a Turkish form of love poetry, as it was taught to me at Harvard when I was in graduate school there at the Divinity School. And I was taught by this German woman who was like 90 years old. Her name was Anna Marie Schimmel. And she was a great teacher, but she was very distinct in the fact that she would recite all of her lectures with her eyes closed and her head thrown back next to the blackboard for an hour and a half. You just take notes and notes and notes and notes. It was an incredible experience just to watch this take place. It was there that I learned about this form. They were written by Rumi, and he had a religious experience through. He wrote these to his friend Shamsa Tabriz, who was his beloved, and it was through that that he was writing these poems. I think if I remember it right, one of their distinguishing characteristics is that each 2 lines makes up its own poem. So the poem will jump around as the mind does, or my mind does, from one thing to the next. And it's in memory of my cousin, John Stephen Reese, who was murdered in Florida the year I graduated from college. My family never recovered from that. And as we were honoring Larry Lovis beginning this reading and hearing him now through his poems, I thought I wanted to close with this because John, my cousin, is long gone and I can never get him back or undo his murder. But in writing this poem, it was an attempt to sort of make sense of it and to remember somebody who would be all but forgotten. He was 23 when he was murdered. So here's the poem. Florida Ghazals in memory of John Stephen Reese. 1. Down here, the sun clings to the earth and there is no darkness. Down here, the silence of the sea and the silence of the swamp seep into our muscles. All night, Dolores labors between the sea grapes and the empty park, our town prostitute, she listens for a long time. Her listening makes her strong. The teenage boy locks his door and combs the obscene magazine. His calloused left hand chops the gloss in waves. The silence of the naked ladies builds. The Cape Sable seaside sparrow's population dropped 25%. Females are silent. Male calls are counted and multiplied by 16. This is how we track what cannot be seen. Gay waiters examine their haircuts in the mirrors. Perhaps tonight their pursuit of love will end in some permanence. Juan escapes from our prison. He duct tapes Playboy magazines to his rib cage. With his glossy carapace, he vaults over the razor strips of the chain link fence. Egas Moniz wins the Nobel Prize in 1949 for pioneering lobotomies. I am a pioneer of silence, but the silencing of madness haunts me because it is unresolved. Two. The hairdresser measures his delicate architecture. Do all of life's devotions dissolve at the shores of the day's ugly punches? Dolores teases her blonde hair a foot into the air. Her hair, the one perfection in this low-income town, a conspicuous example of Darwinian sexual selection. Consider the teenage boy again. His locked room is a diorama of loneliness. He bucks his hips until his hurricanes of desire are arrested. Then comes a deep silence. Weather, how's the weather? When I speak of the weather, is it because I cannot speak of my days spent in the nut house? Juan sinks into the swamp thick with processed excrement. Nude paper ladies sink him like cement, silencing him. The men in the gym slow down their repetitions. Their biceps grow. They are silent in their strength. When does silence go from being an asset to a liability? All this beauty, butterflies at the ankles, birds. When hurricanes come with their bad names, they ruin this place like madness. Three. Elizabeth Bishop was 5 when her mother went mad. They locked her mother away in Nova Scotia, and Elizabeth never saw her again. The men on death row are gathering in their silence, not unlike the Miccosukee tribal leaders who sit in their thatched huts in the swamp and murmur over mistakes made. The black prison guards shoot bullets into the dark and swear at Juan. Their blue armpits open and close. They will not be satisfied with anything but silence. Tonight, the gym fills with strong male groans. I am among these wordless men, bent on increasing their size. I keep vigil by the light of my 60-watt bulb. The unmarked mass grave of the 1928 hurricane beckons me. Long ago, my cousin was murdered, drowned in a river in St. Augustine. He was 23 years old. My aunt went mad. Now I speak for the dead. In the summer, there is heat, silence, and no people. This is the weather of poetry. In the summer, it rains sideways, leaking through the roofs of our mouths. Four. When Elizabeth Bishop lived in Key West, the sea breeze brushed her with peace. This aquamarine sea, these royal poems assuaged her, so too with me. Even at Christmas, hornets hiss in the kiss of the hibiscus. Our seasons come upon us silently. I hear Juan drown in the night, his mouth stuffed with rain. The swamp water jiggles its razors at his throat. When I come out at last from the dark, I am committed. I press my fingers on the keys. There are no more locked wards. At dawn, the pelican spears the sea spastically. Down here, everything gushes with the phlegm of dependency. Bethesda by the sea cools with the gossip of the dead. The ministers attend to the living, inserting wafers like coins dropped into slot machines. Florida is a frontier built by escapees. We electrocute men. No one's past is certain. 5. Philomela held her cut tongue in her hand like a ticket. Although her past was heavy, her silence strengthened her, gave her wings. In Lantana at night, the 1950s pink tubercular sanatorium glows with fluorescence. Behind the dirty jealousy window slats, the AIDS patients play cards. When I came to this place, I had nothing of the past, no photo albums, nothing. Silence is my ancestor. That night, my cousin must have been scared, surrounded by the muscles of men. He must have fought back. He must have cried out. Or was he silent? I press on the keys of the typewriter, attempting to record all those lost and unmarked, but there are too many. I cannot keep track. The Haitian ladies throw back their regal heads and move down the sidewalk slow, as if they were on the deck of a ship taking them away from some awful place. Alligators swallow the summer light. The thick grass eats the sidewalk. Whatever is built here is quickly overrun with the advance of chlorophyll. 6. Robert Fitzroy, the father of weather forecasting, slit his throat with a razor. Is it brooding on the future that drives us mad? The silence of it. In a room, in an institution, I was. Behind me, a window with rain. A chaplain attended me. We had nothing to share but silence. Lantana, where I live, is home to the National Enquirer. Their one-story locked headquarters resemble mental houses. One year I lived in a Moorish hacienda built in 1924. The walls were 2 feet thick. My neighbor was a peeping Tom. At night, his feet crushed the grass like a cat's paws. In the bluish-purple bruise of dawn, Dolores watches weather on TV channeled from a dish. She lost her only son in Vietnam, and now there can be no silence. Waves open and close like doors between these islands called keys. Seahorses shift in the shallows like coy Tiresiases and say, "Relax, everyone's bisexual." At night, I hear the electric chair whir. Men who make terrible mistakes disappear here. 7. In the store, there was a man who was more beautiful than his wife. The man flirted with me, then showed a wallet. Inside was a picture with children. Easter in Palm Beach and at the Everglades Club, the ladies sit before lemon tarts on filigreed plates, their sprayed hair fastened on their heads like conch shells. When the 1928 hurricane came, it had no name. Lake Okeechobee broke, and 2,000 migrant workers drowned in their shacks. It was dark, and my cousin was alone. They dragged him to the river. It rained for 3 days. They could not find him. When they did, no one knew his name. In church, we hear the jungle growing to meet the sea. Each Sunday, we remember the dead in silence, but it is not enough. Florida has no memory besides the monarch butterflies who remember everything. The sea glitters, fish disappear like keys. Oh, this land of exits, this land of forgetfulness. When the last day of summer comes, the locals walk home wistful, discounted. Down here, the lonely claim my voice and make it strong. Thank you very, very much.